Okay, so the next bit of this topic is the the subject of tudong, which is a Thai word that is also kind of means, you know, like a pilgrimage, wandering pilgrimage, which in the usually it tends to refer to monks, but especially in the old days, certainly lay people would wander as well, and you know, visit teachers, visit holy sites, or go on meditation. And you know, to a certain extent, people still do it today in Thailand. and tudong comes from the word dutanga from the Pali, and that are 13 particular practices that the Buddha allowed but didn't make mandatory. So, like, they're practices of simplicity, so being a bit more austere, a bit more simple, a bit more focused, mostly around requisites, say, like, simplifying the robes that we wear, simplifying the place that we're living in. Depending on the time of year, if we're outside of the rainy season, then you could just stay under at the root of a tree or out in the open, and that would be a dutanga practice. But say, like at the time of the Buddha, you wouldn't do it in the rainy season. Or doing something like sitter's practice, where you're not lying down, which say that, you know, we can do that as a, just even on a, say on the weekly observance nights, do it just one night. Or some people take it on for longer periods of time. But generally the word tudong usually means kind of, yeah, wandering and practicing in the forest, practicing in places of simplicity, or wandering to go to particular teachers or shrines. And most certainly most forest monasteries would try to experiment with that, and depending, say like Ajahn Chah, sometimes he'd encourage it and sometimes he wouldn't. Because sometimes he'd see, I remember this one time, this particular monk, very, very restless, very bored, very fed up, wanted to leave to go on tudong, and Ajahn Chah said, you know, why do you have to go anywhere? Just pack up all your gear, put it in your bag, and walk around the monastery all day. And spend the night in the forest and come home, and then after the meal do it again, you know. So that was his idea of tudong for that monk. So it's also, you know, that sense of simplifying and you know, sort of doing something that one has to put forth a bit of effort. There's one monk who there was a Western monk who was really restless and very, it was just you could hardly, he's, you know, bouncing in his skin, and came to Ajahn Chah, and it was the hot season at the time, and he was fed up. It's hot. It's, you know, it's just, it's bored, came to Ajahn Chah. It was because he was only about 2 or 3 reigns at the time. Normally, you'd have to have at least 5 years of training in order to go off and be practicing on his own. So, but he was just so restless. I got to ask Ajahn Chah anyway. And Ajahn Chah gave him permission. But then he said, yeah, you can go. I think it's a really good thing. Encourage them. He said, but, you know, to do it properly, you know, you should really, you shouldn't accept any rides. And you shouldn't stay any place more than, 1 or 2 nights. And no more than 3 nights in one place. And of course, at that point, the monk was ready to agree to anything. He was going to get out. So he went off on Tudong. About a month later, he came back. And I saw him. I said, wow, okay, how'd it go? He said, that bloody Ajahn Chah, he tricked me again. He said, it was miserable. Just walking in the sun every day, it's hot season. So you're just sort of getting to settle down after a day or two in one place. Okay, this night, I got to leave. I made the promise to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah, he said, it was awful. I said, I'm happy to be back. Which, of course, was the point of the exercise for Ajahn Chah. It was a long way around that. Okay. So that Tudong, you know, it should be something that you're learning from. Yeah, it isn't really about the journey, isn't really about the destination, isn't really about whatever goal you set. It should be, you know, a learning process. So that's something that, in terms of, okay, what validity does that have to for lay people? And certainly picking up something and being willing to learn from it and reflecting on the aspects of simplicity, of effort, what is my intention? What's my... Because those are the sort of things we have to be investigating all the time. I mean, if mindfulness of breathing, if it's going to be successful, it has to really be attentive to and learn, you know, well, what is my intention? What is the volition behind it? What kind of energy am I applying? How am I complicating this? Which is pretty ordinary for us as human beings. The most simple thing, we're incredibly capable at making it complicated. So that this aspect of Tudong as an example of how to hold, how to reflect on different things. But then when one takes it on consciously as a certain practice, and can really learn a lot from that. thinking of, say, the example of Ajahn Mun, this monk here, is considered the grandfather of the modern Thai forest tradition. He died when he was mid to late 70s, and it wasn't until the last 5-6 years of his life, 7-8 years of his life, I can't remember now, that he spent, after the range retreat, he'd just start wandering and practice in quiet places, and he didn't spend the range retreat in a consecutive place, a monastery for us, until he was getting close to 70, starting to sort of when energies were starting to wane a bit and starting to become a bit more settled. So that's amazing, really. And he ended up having a following, a huge following, people wanting to train under him, to learn, study with him. So he's an incredible, charismatic, exemplary teacher. And that simplification is an important part of it. When I think there's a story that I've told to the community of Ajahn Lee Damodaro. He's the first disciple of Ajahn Ajahn Mun, who came out of the northeast of Thailand and came to central Thailand to teach, sort of bringing the forest tradition out of the northeast at a time when communication, transportation were very basic. And so he would go off wandering from time to time. Lay people noticed that and asked if he would take them on Tudong, on one of his Tudong trips. And he said, yeah, sure. And he thought, well, I'll take them up to the north, where he did a lot of wandering up there. Ajahn Mun did a lot of wandering. Weather's quite cool, pleasant. So made an appointment let's all meet at the central train station in Bangkok and we'll go up to the north and I'll take you on Tudong. So everybody starts to gather at the central train station, catch the train up to Chiang Mai, and he starts noticing that people are coming with suitcases and bags and boxes and food and whatever. They had everything. And he just sort of took a look at that and he said, okay, let's start Tudong. And he started walking down the railroad tracks. And then everybody said, okay, you've got to follow the Ajahn. So he said, pick up stuff and start carrying. And it didn't take very long that they're getting rid of all sorts of stuff. I think they walked for most of that day. They made it to Don Mueang, which is the old airport. It's about 20 kilometers outside of the city, 15, 20 kilometers outside of central. And he said, okay, people have shed quite a lot already now. Okay, let's get on the train. So that, if you're carrying everything, you really start to know, okay, what's essential, what's necessary. I mean, some people here have probably done backpacking trips, and you start divesting yourself of stuff pretty quickly once you're carrying it every day. Ajahn Chah tells of when he first went on Tudong. He'd been a monk for 7 or 8 years, I think, by then. He'd never wandered off as a monk anywhere. And he and a friend of his were going to central Thailand. And Ajahn Chah said, we packed everything we could. And they even brought a cloak. It's like a mortar and pestle. Stone. He said, oh, heavy. Yeah, he said that didn't last long. So that you just start when you're carrying it and relying on stuff, you become, and you learn how to be content with that simplicity. So that that's something that one learns from Tudong, from wandering as a pilgrimage practice or wandering as a practice. I think here in America, then probably the analogous thing is it's like backpacking in the wilderness, and going out and meditating and practicing in those kinds of places. I mean, we tend to our community tends to go every year to the High Sierras, but we don't do it as a wandering practice with backpacks and whatnot. We tend to set up a camp and then go off. We go out there to just be in nature, and to do day trips or just to stay close to camp and meditate. It's wonderful. So those are aspects of Tudong, in the sense of what's its purpose, how to use it, why do people do it. Remember, Ajahn Chah would, he was, I remember him lamenting the fact that the forests in Thailand were being destroyed so quickly that there's not much place for monks to wander anymore. It's really quite true. That practice of a wandering forest monk in Thailand is quite it's not so easy to accomplish anymore because there just aren't that. I'd say within a period of maybe 30 years, late 1950s to the late 1980s. Probably, 90% of the forests in Thailand cut down. Astounding destruction in a short period of time, and what it did was make many monks turn to being more place-oriented and protect the forests that were left. Because without monks there, then the places really get destroyed. That's like Ajahn Tan. He was here last year, a year before. He probably has one of the last pieces of forest in this area of northern Chonburi. All the rest are all sort of like palm oil and rubber plantations. And his is the last small piece of natural forest. And that was, he got there and sort of said, he'd been wandering for some time. He said, I better stay here, otherwise this is going to be destroyed as well. So that's his monastery, is this protected place. And even Ajahn Chah sort of said, well, yes. Nowadays it's hard to Tudong because to Lutdong, you go through the forest before you even realize it. Dong, it's a play on words. Thais love to make word plays. It's a play on words. But it means sort of, just sort of gone through the forest, already gone through it. But so those aspects of simplicity, using the opportunity to be in a place of nature, in order to practice being in a keeping a focus on that, you know, relinquishing the things that we find comfortable or convenient, and just seeing how little we can get by with, and you realize, oh, there's a lot of scope there. Or also just sometimes like facing one's fears. I mean, that sort of, you know, what's it going to be like if I don't have the things that I'm used to? Start recognizing where one's security lies, one's comforts, one's or just being in a place what you're not familiar with. Being in a place where there's wild animals. I mean, there, you know, those are areas that we start to look at kind of deep-seated feelings of fear and insecurity, and that's interesting to contemplate. It's interesting to see. Because it really does give us, once we start to look at that and see it more clearly, understand it, it gives us tremendous confidence. So that feeling of independence and confidence, those are helpful qualities for supporting one's practice, one's training. So that's what say Tudong practice helps to do. So that's a kind of an intro to Tudong as a practice. And anybody have any questions?
I just noticed. I think one of Ajahnamara's first Tudong in England. The lay people go out.
Well, it depends how you want to do it. I mean, if you want to put all that effort into organizing, then yeah, I mean, it's okay. But then you're bound by that, so that eliminates the possibility of spontaneity. Once you set a program, you've got to keep with it, and you make a commitment to the lay people, asking them to do something. So that, there's benefits and drawbacks. Certainly in the early days in England, he was one of the first to even try it. And that was, what was that? That was probably about 1984, 85, he just finished his fifth Pansa. And so it's early days of Sangha in England, and then he was going to walk from Chithurst to Harnham, which was from the south to the north. So it's, it's a long way. And nowadays, the monks and the nuns there, I don't think they do any kind of organization. They'll tend to just go off wandering. But England is actually incredibly easy to do that, because the distances are small. There's villages everywhere. And not only that, you've got the public footpaths. All through the country, it's amazing. So yeah, England is sort of a, like a Tudong, a Tudong monk's dream. except for the weather. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's really true. Because yes, listening to some of the stories of going Tudong in England, and you know, you've been soaking wet for day. Everything is soaking wet. You're sleeping in a soaking wet sleeping bag. Ugh.
I just made up the story of that, but this tent that leaves.
Yes.
King Jay and I did our walk before we did the Mississippi one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we planned it where we stayed at Dee's house, but we had every single night planned.
Yeah.
And he said it's all about learning experience, and we learned from that, don't plan. We had a great time at your house.
Yeah.
What happens if you lose your spoon?
Oh, that's the least of your worries. It's a spoon's easy. I mean, you've got a hand. You can eat with your hand. But there's lots of other things you really don't want to lose. But that's also, you know, in terms of Tudong, your requisites, whatever you've got to be paying attention to looking after them. Because if you lose them, forget them somewhere, then they're gone.
I have a question. So I kind of understand that the way that Tudong is can be a metaphor of practice as well, right?
Yes.
Because I feel like when we carry a lot of heavyweight stuff for a long time, we get tired.
Yeah.
So in our practice, we might need to drop something as well. Do I understand?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a, you know, it is a metaphor, and to that's one of the just kind of, you know, kind of our Tudong through life. How do we wander through life? And what are the burdens we're carrying? How many blisters are we getting? and how do we look after them? You know, so, you know, there's all sorts of ways of interpreting that to everyday life. Alex?
As a lay people, how do we know, like, if it's a good or a bad time to go on Tudong?
Well, I think one is the on a certain level, if there's always the hesitation and fear and uncertainty, I think as soon as the idea is conceived, then that's a good time. You know, go for it. It isn't so much about, okay, did you reach a destination? Were you successful? Similarly, what did you learn from it? And that's the beneficial aspect. Okay, what did I learn? What did it highlight? What can I take away from it?
So that, do you find that for yourself or other monks who decide to go on Tudong, there's the initial impulse to do it and intention to do it, and then once it's going to happen, kind of an upwelling of uncertainty or question?
I would think that's pretty universal, yeah.
So there's a willingness to let go of the security and safety of right here.
Yes,
and
then,
oh my God.
What have I done? You know. and then one moves into the adventure, and then it vacillates, and, you know, and there's the kind of the excitement, and then there's a sort of when is this going to be over? And, you know, so all of the reactions and moods. And of course, that's part of why one's doing it, to sort of see, where's the holding? Where's the resistance? Where's the Where's the sort of the inner weasel trying to get out of something? Yeah, so those are aspects of what we can learn from that. And as I said, it's not Ajahn Chah saying, stay in the monastery, go around. or he would sometimes, some monks would want to go Tudong, and he'd give them a lecture, raising the example of a very famous monk in Thailand, Jakun Naw, who was he was a member of the royal family, and he ordained as a monk, and he came from upper kind of class Thai society, and he actually told his family or supporters to bring a particular foods that was what he was going to eat, and they supplied, and that was what he got every single day. Mm-hmm. He never went off on alms round, stayed in his kuti. He never left the monastery, and he turned into this extremely respected practitioner, and he lived in the center of Bangkok. It's very close to the, just between the Central Railroad Station and Chinatown, the heart of old Bangkok. And after living and practicing like that, then he is highly respected. And Ajahn Chah would lift that up as an example. What do you need to go Tudong for? Why aren't you more like Jakun Naw? Why don't you learn from what the situation you're in? So it's sort of the one's trying to find the tools, and Tudong is one of them, or wandering and pilgrimage. Those are tools that we see in our array of practices that we can draw on to learn and understand more about the Dhamma, about ourselves, so that the sense of using these tools.
It kind of speaks of a bodhisattva Zen style approach to karma, because it's more like your attitude towards your karma, sort of. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, like a bodhisattva will say, say, sure, you can insult me, and you'll make merit by insulting me. Mm-hmm. It sort of turns it around on you.
Well, I think that's what the, there's that sense of just, especially in terms of Tudong as an ethos, is giving oneself to uncertainty and you're there for everything and everybody, so that. And that's certainly one of the things that happens. It's like one of the, say, in terms of when we went over the structure for the day, preparing, one of the things was for me to talk about Tudong in India. Ajahn Jaya Sarwar and myself went without any lay people or any kind of props or support, going to another country, And India, which is if you want to experience uncertainty, then it's sort of uncertainty on steroids. so we arrange for tickets to... the idea was that we would fly into Calcutta, change planes, fly to Benares. We had tickets to Benares, and then we would walk from Benares, from the airport to the holy site in Sarnath, and then walk to Bodh Gaya, then walk to Rajgir, Nalanda, then Patna, which is on the Ganges River. There's a city there, and we had a plane ticket from Patna back to Calcutta for our trip back to Bangkok. And so we get on the plane in Bangkok, and we land in Calcutta, and we get off the plane, go into the terminal, and of course it's total chaos. And Air India is on strike. and what do we do? Everybody was bombarding the ticket officers with... you couldn't hardly talk with them, and everything was totally chaotic. And we tried to sort of ask around, and then finally... we went and sat at the meditation in the terminal near the ticket office for Air India, and after sitting meditation there for a while, then one of the people who worked at the ticket office came over and asked, is there any way we can help you? And said, well, we flew in. We're supposed to be on a flight to Benares, and so anyway, talking back, I said, well, you in order to validate that ticket, there's going to be a flight tomorrow. You just have to go into the ticket office in Calcutta, and then come out after. I said, well, we have no money. He said, well, it's only, however many paisa or rupee to go into the just to get the bus in. I said, no, it's not that we don't have a little money. We don't have any money. We are Buddhist monks. We don't touch money. We don't handle money. I said, oh. and then he ended up sort of saying, he said, well, I could get you on the flight Patna tomorrow morning without having, I can make that happen. So I said, okay, well, we'll change the whole plan and we'll figure out the rest later. So we said, okay, tomorrow morning. So we went in, we got it sorted out. It was tomorrow in the afternoon. There was a flight to Patna, so okay, we'll get on that. So then we had to go find a place to stay. We went and found, just wandered out of the airport and wandered off into the area, neighborhood, found a Hindu temple, asked to spend the night. Nobody spoke English. We spent the night and covered in mosquito bites next morning. It was just... so many mosquitoes. I mean, I grew up in northern Canada, and I know what mosquitoes are like. This was worse, and because it all came up in welts. It looked like the two of us had got measles.
It's only the first day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we didn't even got anywhere yet. So then, walk back to the airport, get on the plane. We end up in Patna late afternoon, and then we've got to try to figure out, where's the airport, and then where's the road that's going to take us to Nalanda. So we got that figured out. This is days before GPS, you just look on your smartphone and see where things are. But it ended up, it was sort of like, it was the opposite end of Patna. So we had to walk through Patna we finally sort of got to the outskirts of Patna. It's probably about 11 o'clock at night. We'd been walking about 11 o'clock or midnight. And we spent the night in an Islamic cemetery. And they were happy to let us stay in this shelter in the cemetery. So we finally got settled and then early morning comes along and the imam was doing his chanting first thing in the morning. So it was discombobulated. And then we managed to just start walking early in the morning. Again, not really, you have to trust. You have to trust a lot. And also in India, we'd heard that already, that generally in India they won't have an early morning meal. They have a very light kind of breakfast, so nobody really cooks first thing in the morning. So there's no point in going alms round in the early morning like you do in Thailand, because Thais have cook rice and eat first thing in the morning. But they don't do that in India. So you've got to figure out or have a sense of what the customs are. And then if it's cool and we're not going to get any food anyway, there's no point in going alms round. Let's just get on the road and start walking. And then as it gets around probably about 9:30 or something, then find a village and go wandering for alms. And mostly people didn't recognize what you were, because Buddhist monks are not ordinary, but they recognize you as some sort of a sadhu, some sort of a religious seeker. In India, respects religious seekers. So what we did, before we left, we went to the Indian Tourist Bureau in Bangkok, and we asked them to write out a little sort of card, which we laminated, and it said, we're Buddhist monks on pilgrimage to the holy sites. We eat one meal. We eat one meal a day that's offered by lay people. We don't accept money. Just give us who you are, what you do, and when people start asking and coming up, then you sort of show that to them, and it worked all the time, and people were. Oh, then they figured it out. Okay, this is what this kind of sadhu does. We got looked after really well. What was really interesting was that, you're wandering in the Indian countryside. It's the poorest part of India. Bihar is considered very poor, as well as the most dangerous, but people were really warm and friendly and looked after us, and in some places made sure that we didn't stay outside, saying that the villagers said, no, this is dangerous, you have to come into the village and stay in there. Oftentimes there's Hindu shrines around, and so that you stay at a Hindu shrine, It's easy to do. Or schools or people's barns or all sorts of things. And so we got treated as religious seekers in the Indian countryside. And then when we got to the holy sites, it was like you're either treated as a tourist or ignored. So you'd be, people were following around, begging from you, pestering, whatever. Or there wasn't a perception of doing anything because you were just some other Buddhist monk. And most of the Buddhist monks that go through tend to be with a group of pilgrims or, whatever. So they're tend not to be recognized as a samana, as a religious seeker. So that was interesting. And just wandering the countryside, sort of going to these sites. So the first place that we got to was Nalanda, and there's a Thai temple there. And when we got there, the abbot wasn't going to let us stay. We weren't paying customers. And there was two groups of kind of Thai pilgrims coming, so that we were just kind of scruffy add-ons. Finally, we kind of prevailed, and because we were pretty blistered and sore and tired, and it was good to have a bit of a break from being on the road. And we woke up the next morning, and we were in this little shrine in the temple, and we heard a whole sort of kerfuffle of people coming in during the night. And then we got up in the morning, and those two groups came. One group was led by Ajahn Khun, who was the abbot of one of the branch monasteries of Wat Pa Phong. He was leading a group on pilgrimage. The other one was an even more senior monk who was the abbot he was contemporary to Ajahn Chah. He had several monasteries of his own that I'd stayed at, and he had wanted to offer his monasteries to be branch monasteries of Wat Pa Phong. Mm-hmm. Tremendous mutual respect between his monasteries and Ajahn Chah's. But Ajahn Chah sort of said, we're kind of contemporary. It doesn't feel right. We can exchange monks. People can go back and forth. But anyway, so that I knew the two monks who had the group there. Then they start asking, what are you doing? So we explained to them, and then also said, there was a bit of a snafu in Calcutta, and that we'd have to figure out how to get to because we'd used up our ticket. So we still had the ticket from Patna to back to Calcutta, but we'd used the sort of Calcutta Benares. They'd taken us to Patna, so with it, and so we would have had to figure out how are we going to get from Benares to Patna to get our plane back again, and so the Ajahn Khun sort of said, "Oh, that's no problem. We'll just tell the lay people, and we're going to further on in our pilgrimage." We're going there. We'll leave some offerings at the Thai temple there. We'll ask the abbot there to arrange for transportation for you to get back to Putna. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, things happen, and when you you know, sort of give yourself the opportunity to experience that uncertainty, and you know, things. If I'd tried to figure it out, I would never have been able to do it. But you just sort of, you kind of try, okay, something's going to happen. Something. So that we did, you know, we wandered and, you know, spent time in different places, as I said. Whether it was in temples, Hindu temples, Buddhist temples, schools, barns, the whole range of things. And people are just incredibly kind. And then when we made it to Bodh Gaya, then Ajahn Jayasaro said, "Gee, this is taking longer than I thought. I made this aditana, this determination, to walk the whole way. And, you know, I think I'm going to have to get going, like, you know, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. You know, we're going to have to get going in order to make it to Benares in time." And I started thinking, but I didn't make that determination. So I said, I really want to just spend more time in Bodh Gaya and do pujas, and said, I'll meet you there and I'll get all the things organized for us to get back. So he said, you don't have to worry about that. So he said, okay, meet you in at the Thai temple in Sarnath. And I started, you know, going, you know, really every day going to the, for, I can't remember how many days I stayed, but every day, several times a day, going and doing pujas and meditation. And then this Indian man came up to me, he just started asking questions and talking to me. And he had a small business in Bodh Gaya, and he wanted to follow me. I said, I'm not looking for a follower. And anyway, it was impossible. He was a... and it was really... One of the things I was talking with him was really interesting, because he said, I've been observing your etiquette. And he said, you know, I grew up in a Kshatriya clan, and, you know, your etiquette and the way you do things is very similar to how I've been grew up and how I was taught. I said, well, that's not strange, because all of our kind of minor rules and training and etiquette come from the Buddha, and he was a Kshatriya, he was a warrior caste, and the Buddha used that as a template to give a standard of conduct that was, say, acceptable in Indian society and culture. So that was a, you know, it was a really interesting thing to learn. He was interested, and then he we ended up taking a train and getting part of the way, and then walking further along to get to Benares. So he ended up taking me to Sarnath, and then he took me into Benares, and I got to see the because Benares itself has been a pilgrimage site for Hindus for maybe 4,000 years. So it's a this amazing sort of place in and of itself. So those are some Indian stories on Tudong. Another sidebar of Indian Tudong is the Ajahn Jayasaro's British, and so he, you know, you're walking, and you know the things you end up talking about are sometimes you never quite know what's going to kind of pop up in a conversation. So he started, because Indians are cricket mad. And so then he spent a lot of time trying to explain cricket so I could understand what... trying to get me to understand cricket. It's part of my religious practice. Oh my gosh, yes. It's absolutely everywhere. And if there's, you know, the whole country stops. And certain big cricket games, big cricket matches. So any questions?
Is it difficult for two monks to get along the whole time?
It depends on the monks. Ajahn Jayasaro and I get along really well, always have. There's different temperaments and personalities. So some get along and some don't.
What about bowls? Do you split up what's given, or does one guy stare at the others like, are you
going to
eat some of that?
Oh, well, it would depend on what happened. I mean, we certainly share. But also, you know, some of the offerings in... oftentimes what would happen in India is they want you to eat in the house. When you have your bowl, then they really don't want to do that. They'd rather give you... And also what they do is they give you... And it's really interesting because you read the suttas and the Vinaya, and it mirrors. When I've read it before, I didn't really understand it until I went to India. Because what they do is they will put food on your plate and you eat it, and then they're watching, and then as soon as it's almost finished, and then they come forward and offer more, and they'll keep doing that. If you keep eating it, they'll keep offering it. So that that's how we mostly would be eating.
And did you slept outdoors though?
Yes, although it was outdoors in different ways, in the sense of it could be outdoors. The really outdoors one was at the Buddha's Kuti at Vulture's Peak, which we had to hide because the authorities there go through the whole site and sort of get everybody out of the site. And then it's locked at night. So we found a place to sort of hang out and waited for the end of the day. Then we went to the Buddha's Kuti. We went to actually Sariputta's cave first and spent a bit of time. I mean, Sariputta was enlightened there. Ajahn Jayasaro and I had some coffee. It's a different experience. and then we went to the Buddha's Kuti when just at dusk, and we spent the night there until it got very good, because it was cold season and it can be quite cold, and it was very exposed there. So then we went and found a cleft in the rocks where we could at least get away from the wind.